in the late 40s, you should understand that the hostility towards us, towards so-called action painters, abstract expressionists, the attack upon us was led by the head of the art department at Columbia University, Professor Peppino Mongrovitti. Professor Peppino said that Picasso and Matisse have discovered all that is discoverable in art. And what we should do, we should consolidate these discoveries. And this was put to his students to consolidate the discoveries of Picasso and Matisse. There was a political underlay to this by politics that Picasso was a high-ranking member of the Cominform, on par with the Premier of Italy, Togliatti, the head of the Italian Communist Party, and other such people. And
you mean in France he was part of it?
Yes, he was, but as an expatriate Spaniard representing Spain, you see. So there was this sort of left-wing underlay to all of this kind of thing. And a great deal of turbulence in the 40s, because there was an unwavering support of the Soviet as, you know, the darlings who would save mankind. And what was overlooked was, what a dreadful society that was. With the war, there were people who cast this aside yet further, people like Maya Shapiro, and supported the idea of a popular front, you see, which is one of the kind of shadow organization set up by the Soviets all over the world.
Okay, just for clarity, I need to, so I can stay with you.
Okay.
It sounds like you've moved away from New York. You're talking about Europe now in terms of...
No, not really. I'm talking about that if you came to New York during those times, you had to have a left-wing agenda in your...
As an artist.
As an artist, you see. And you sought the sponsorship of historians who supported the Popular Front, even after the fracture when the Soviets signed a peace agreement with Nazi Germany. There were many who jumped overboard when this occurred.
So this is like mid-40s?
This is mid-40s, yeah. So you had this mentality, you know, Shapiro supported, there was a show of about 180 painters that he supported with words. And
not when was that?
I think this was in 47, 48. And then overnight he changed. He changed to a different political agenda. No longer in support of these things. The idea of an American school of art seemed ridiculous, and there were paid hands who fought this poverty-stricken group. You're not talking about you know, opinionated people on a street corner in a bar, but André Malraux, the French historian, was given, he became a minister without portfolio in the French cabinet, and it was his job to shoot down this threat to French trade. To shoot down that school specifically and insult it. This was a country recovering from war, and one of their great assets was the export of French paintings of the modern schools. that yielded them close to $2 billion a year. And they saw this emergence of an American school as threatening to themselves, and they attacked it vigorously. In England, Aldous Huxley attacked this as thanked America for helping them during the war, and blah, 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 but these paintings, the work of idiots, said he, was a warning of the Coca-Colonization of Europe. See, the only people who were really sympathetic were the Italians, who of course were defeated in war and would, you know, kiss anybody's ass, you know. But no, they weren't part of this attack. And Germany was also similarly prostrate, although they came up with painters who flocked to Paris and did able work, like Karl Appel. Anyway, there was all, and this opposition to what we did was supported by the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. I found myself involved in picket lines. We picketed them. Every year they had a yearly show of paintings and an invitational that was traditional, you know, that went back to the turn of the century. And frankly, if you turned up with an action painting, you were told to get lost or get out of there. And if they were left on the premises of this museum, they could be vandalized. This is made clear to you. So they, these older painters like Tworkov and de Kooning, Mark Rothko, got out on the streets and picketed this and made it clear what was happening. So we had to find the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Yeah. And finally, they were unrelenting, you see. They would not allow our work in there. There were only 12 galleries that really attended to our work, and they were very insecure with it. They thought, well, this is a phase that people are going to grow out of, but hell, this man has been doing this for years, and we'll give him a break, you know, we'll have a show for him and then get him out of it, keep him off the premises.
For instance,
to illustrate the disrespect for paintings, I had a friend, the mother of Robert De Niro is an interesting person who worked with this theatre group that trained such people as Marilyn Monroe and of course Robert De Niro himself. She was the secretary there.
Kazan?
Actors Guild or something,
an actor's studio, actor,
yeah,
something.
Anyway, I forgot what I was.
Well, you were going to, what I asked for an example of was you said.
An example, yeah. Okay. So, anyway, Robert would go there to see his wife.
Method acting,
yeah. So he would frequently go there because he was divorced from his wife, and they were still trying to, you know, they had a son, and being Italian, he was really overwrought by this. And I picked up some friends who were doing method acting, and one was a young actor named James Dean, you see. And James was getting kicked around because they felt that he was mimicking or aping Marlon Brando. And this was a sensitive guy. And he was a vision in cowboy boots, black Levi's and a leather jacket, or, you know, an ordinary looking fellow. Now, this incident that I'll relate will illustrate the lack of esteem for us. I was uptown. There was a big battle in the Poindexter Gallery with it was the Egon Poindexter Gallery, and Charlie Egon was really a great dealer who brought all these people about. When you talk about de Kooning, Franz Klein, all of these people, they all had a chance to show for the first time with Charlie Egon. Of course, he was a pain in the ass. He would get drunk, he'd bet your models, you know, there was always a fist fight or a brawl. As son of a bitch would tell you, I have more talent than you bunch of mothers, you know. And but he sold our paintings.
He was a gallery owner?
Yeah, a gallery despised by the other gallery dealers, you see. So anyway, he was thrown out of the partnership. He looked for money to support his painters, who he believed in, and Poindexter came out of the woodwork and said, I'll give you money, you know, and he did, but there was a minor case of embezzlement on the part of Charlie, which was an embezzlement. He kited a check.
Egan Poindexter Gallery,
Egan Poindexter Gallery.
Okay.
And anyway, Poindexter is a somewhat explosive man, and he learned of the check kiting. It was a $70 piece of sculpture by Ruben Nakian. He put $100, you know, converted to $170. So
he changed the check.
Yeah, we didn't give a damn. We knew that he was doing. We thought, Jesus Christ, sometimes we have nothing to damn or eat, and this son of a bitch believes this. We don't care, because this is what he has to do. You know.
I understand the story. When he did that, the artist got more money. Was that it, or?
No. He kited a check.
I don't know what that means.
Okay. When you kite a check, if you have $70.00, but you mark one. And make it 100 cents,
right.
And you do this to your advantage,
to your own,
forgetting you're now in a partnership and you have a fellow checking these checks coming in and the receivables, and Poindexter saw an opportunity to grab all of these painters and kick him out.
Okay.
If you knew so he took over. But so anyway, I thought I'm going to. I know we had a lot of, you know, kind of college painters like David Sowin and other people who mercifully went back to teach or get married or commit suicide. And here were these two men, Cooney and Klein, who I knew intimately, you see. So I said, and I knew they were going over to the Sydney Janus Gallery, which was... an important gallery then. The Janus Gallery would handle works by Picasso. It was an important gallery.
Mm-hmm.
They were told to bring work over and arrange a schedule of shows. I want to say that to describe this situation and the painters that I've mentioned had never been able to muster a one-man show. In the case of Franz Klein, his first one-man show was at the age of 47, and in the case of de Kooning, at the age of 56. Now, I might be off a year plus or minus, but you know, think about that. You know, a show, you had to buy canvases, you have to have room, you had to acquire space. And it's like a lunatic, you know, broken end running for them to put all this together,
right.
You know.
Yeah.
You know, think of that. You have kids here who feel, I have a right to have a one-man show when, you know, they have a thesis show, I understand that. You know, they culminate studies, and then others go out into the real world, you see. But at that time, to show our work, there were just 12 or 13. I always avoid saying 13 galleries. And some of them you had to have a homosexual agenda, you see. Others you had to be left-wing and so on and so forth. Well, I spoke to de Kooning and Klein, who had known me going back to 48. They'd helped me and I helped them. I really helped them more than they helped me. And I said, I know you're going over to Janus. Could you take me with you and introduce me to Mr. Janus? And now one guy's wearing a wool sock cap, you know, like a burglar would fancy, and a navy pea coat, and blue jeans that are streaked with paint. He looked like a bum. Dukuni always looked like a bum. Mm-hmm. And Franz, on the other hand, had these sneakers in which holes were cut in the uppers to let out corns or carbuncles. And he was not a very prepossessing sight. And they were reluctant to take me over there. But the first thing they said to me was, yeah, come with us. Well, we went over there, and we picked up this kid that we knew from Mrs. Ab, the wife of Robert De Niro was, her name was Admiral. I forget the first name, it'll come to me, but it doesn't matter. So James Dean had glommed on to us and to me. So we were all there that day. He was looking at paintings. I said, Jimmy, we're heading over the road. You know, I think I got a break. You know, this is my big day. So here are these three guys. One guy, James Dean, you know, looked like nothing, you know, like, it looked like someone from the West that comes in on a Greyhound bus and wanders around the city, is knocked down, robbed, and murdered. You know, they wind up in the law courts or something or another. He looked like someone who'd gotten out of a Greyhound bus station. And he wasn't dressed in character. That's what he looked like, this sweet guy. Mm-hmm. And the other guys looked like bums. I never thought about that, but I went into the gallery, and they were reluctant to introduce me to Mr. Janus, you see. And finally they did. It was a shambles. And James leaned up against the wall with a leg up against it, you know. I've seen photos of him doing that. But when he was bored and, you know, not wanting to detect...
One leg, sit with it back?
Right, yeah, okay. Up against the wall. And the walls of the gallery were not occupied by paintings. There were paintings that were coming in, and this was a kind of interim. Well, anyway, normally in a gallery, the painter will go into the office, the inner sanctum of the guy who now represents them, you see, mm-hmm. To talk business or what have you. There are other laws about not going to the gallery when your show is up on the walls. That's strictly adhered to. But you'll see violations of this as I move forward. No, you're not allowed in there. The floor of museums, when they, you know, many of them have a policy of no living artists, because they are frightened an artist might arrive drunk and rebellious, vandalize his work, or raise hell. This is that was their riposte to our demonstrations and stuff like that. Well, we're in this gallery, and this guy comes out of the inner sanctum, and he knew about me, you see, and he said, why do you hang around with people like this, with bums like this, see, that?
They were standing there when he said it?
Yes, oh. Yeah. Uh-huh. He didn't say, come in here, I've got something to tell you. And he said, you know, Alfred, you should really become an actor. Look at how you speak and your appearance. And how you dress. I said, I'm dressed because I'm, you know, I'm now working part-time for Prince Cassini, you know, and I do, walking there looking like a bum when I'm an assistant. And I said, these are my work clothes, you see. This evening I'll be just like these guys. He said, you should go to... He said, who's this other bum that they brought in? I said, his name is James Dean. He's an actor working out at the Method. You see, so I thought, well, I won't move over here. I'll have to go back to Poindexter. So then they came up with another show by their new director. And it was five younger Americans, which meant that I'd been downgraded, that I'm now showing with some college students and people like that. All of whom have disappeared.
That was in Poindexter?
Yeah, this was now the Poindexter Gallery. Okay. It's from Egan Poindexter, it's now the Poindexter Gallery.
And that's the show you were put into, Five Younger Americans?
Yeah, yeah. I don't want to talk about it. CJM was the guy who reviewed it for some magazine, and all he had to say was, who paints emotional things, scratches emotional things in bushes and stuff like that, and that was it, you know, two lines. So I really felt profoundly bad about that, because I believe that... this would take off. I never realized that it would take off in the stratospheric way that he did. Time magazine always referred to us as hoodlums, bums, and people who, you know, this is a new field for functional illiterates. By Kermit Lancer, however his wife Faye became an abstractionist and he began to support us. They called us, there was a movie with Marlon Brando, The Wild Ones, and The Ten Americans was called The Wild Ones. You know, this is not the way to treat people. Junior reviewers, as prestigious as Dori Ashton became, she was not prestigious then. She was a young reviewer, you know, getting $20 for a review or something like that, hard work and studying towards a master's at Columbia, a student of Maya Shapiro. So that's what the situation was. Jackson, and then a strange thing happened that was almost tidal in its implications. Life magazine decided that they would put a stop to this Tommy rot, you see.
The trashing of the...
That they felt that we're going to trash these people, and we are going to trash them in a professional manner. You know, the people of this country, not just the people in New York, but all over, look at our photographs, listen to us, and we're going to trash these boys, but we're going to do it with class, you see. That is unanswerable. And for some reason, they fixated, of course, on Jackson Pollock as a fellow who drips paint onto canvas, you see. And the people just loved his work. People in all walks of life. He lived in Cody, Wyoming, but in California, another place was in Cody, Wyoming. They wanted him to come back to Wyoming and run for the Senate. Anyone who can hornswoggle with a bunch of city slickers is what we want in Washington, and so on and so forth. And people started dripping paint, and then they realized that they weren't coming up with these masterpieces, that they fell short. And there was a magic in his painting. So, you know, this move to submerge us just ended. And then another thing happened in a non-transparent way. Nelson Rockefeller had a hatred of the Mexican painters specifically, because they had crucified, he felt, his father. And I was kept on at the gallery as a bodyguard to George Poindexter, because poor Charlie arrived drunk and demand this and demand that. And it was my job to remove.
So you were
hired
as
a bouncer, which was never endeared me to my colleagues, you might say, who all loved Charlie Egan. They really did. They loved that bastard. You know, but you know, he was a sort of disparate, unorganized virus that would come to our support. You really felt like a gangster, and it was a strange amalgam of artists, and their spokesman would be poets. You know, just like a gangster needs a good lawyer, we needed poets to, you know, speak up for us, to write our catalogs and things. And I had Sherry Abel, who wrote my catalogs, sometimes Frank O'Hara. But he was a homosexual, and there were homo sexual dealers, with homosexual artists, you know, who I respect. And he was beholden to them, but a very kind, wonderful guy. I remember him. Whenever I see the Statue of Liberty, I see Frank O'Hara. You know, I see him as representing something iconic, that fellow. Thank God, another good friend of all of us was, in a landscape of disrespect, was John Button, who worked at the museum. He was a friend of, and we could always get in free when John was working, you see. Where was I talking about?
Life magazine tried to trash it backfired
in yes, they do, they did talk to the people all over the country, you see. The country doesn't exist in New York to them. San Francisco exists, and there are some intervening places, but the people kind of there was some instinct that this was a genuine thing, right? A genuine man, you see, and this is what art is all about, and it was American, you see, and this,
Wasn't Clement Greenberg kind of early in the 50s, kind of claiming Jackson Pollock and some of the abstract expression as sort of his territory and defining it and talking it up?
Well, Paul Rosenberg grabbed a hold of de Kooning, and we talk about de Kooning. I don't know why. I don't have an antipathy to Clement Greenberg. I really don't like these people very much. You know. I really don't remember him as a champion of anything, and I don't know why I have a negative reaction to him. I don't remember his nastiness. I realize that, you know, to be opinionated, you'll champion some people. And
right, he had a select few that people that he wrote about. They gave him paintings. I mean, it was not a very clean sort of.
Yeah, there was something wrong there, and.
But he was doing some of that. I mean, you were aware of him, I guess.
Yeah, I was aware of him, but in the pecking order, I couldn't approach him. I was sort of a junior painter, and my work had no leverage or purchase.
Okay. But he was not trashing the action painters or the abstract expressionists.
No, but he... I don't regard him as an early champion.
Okay.
There were people who came about, and the people were unusual. The next big thing that happened to art was the interest that I alluded to before, Nelson Rockefeller.
Yeah.
He had a campaign for governor, and George Poindexter loaned me to him as a bodyguard, and I would appear on the street. And that job lasted for 2 days because the methods used by the people bodyguarding a political candidate are standard, but they are as follows. I hate this I don't dislike this diversion. They felt that, I was asked, what if someone took a swing at the governor? What would you do, Alf? I said, I'd take a swing at the son of a bitch and knock him down. If that's my job, right? They said, no. You don't do that. And it's bad that you think that way. And I said, well, what the hell do I do? Well, you have to block the punch. And if you can anticipate the punch, then tread on the guy's toes, grab and break a finger, or kick him in the balls, so that the press cannot see what's happening. He just falls into a sea of faces. Can't you do that? I said, Jesus. They're meeting on the inside and tonight on the east side, over on 10th Avenue, and you once lived there, right? You know the people, Jews, and there are Puerto Ricans and Italians. So you accompany the governor over there and we'll see how you do, you know. Anyway, so we were eating knishes and Puerto Rican arroz con pollo and then borscht or pea soup, you know, it was a sickening experience for me, and I came down with an intestinal flu. I really have a great deal of respect for people and their political campaigning. And then they felt that I committed a social error by taking a swing at a guy who took a swing at me. And this would have been visible on cameras, and that was intolerable. And I was told about this, and I was kind of dismissed and sent back to George Poindexter. Rockefeller remarked about our paintings, you see, he learned that George Poindexter sent me over. He knew a little bit about them. He said, you know, I love your work. I love the works that these boys are doing because it can do us no harm. And can do us no harm is always something, you know, when a powerful man says that, I think about it. I remember this. This remark, it can do us no harm. And he I met him before. I was going, I take the subway to BMT uptown and get off on 52nd Street, which would be across from Rockefeller Center, or 48th Street, I forget. So these, you can walk below ground to the different exits. Some, you know, you can come up at 48 or 52, so I'm not sure which one. But the one that would bring you across the street from, and there was Nelson Rockefeller, and in a phone booth. And I went to the booth and accosted him, and I said, I'm a painter, and, you know, why can't I show? It was now installed himself as on the board of the Museum of Modern Art, see. Then there was a fire at the Museum of Modern Art when down the road he became governor. And he arrived in a fireman's cap, went up a ladder, and he had a choice of rescuing two paintings. One was by Ensor, Christ Entering Brussels, see, from that series. And the other was a bunch of figures copulating on the landscape by Jan Muller, who's a New York expressionist painter, a product of the Hoffman School and of the Hunzer Gallery. And he willfully ignored the fate of the Ensor, which was ruined, and rescued the friggin' painting of this kid. No, you see. He didn't like Ensor's attitude towards the establishment. They were all pigs and industrialist tycoons and people festering on the...
So people copulating on the landscape. I thought you said fire escape.
No, landscape.
That can do us no harm, I guess.
Right, that can do us no harm.
But so that was an incident that happened after he was elected. That's documentable. I mean,
yes.
That's verifiable.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but you accosted him in the phone booth before then?
Yeah, yeah.
And you had you bodyguarded?
Yeah, but there was no talking to him during the campaign. He spoke to me and knew a little bit about me, and I was really flattered by that. And he knew that George had sent him over.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I don't seem to have a chance in this city to show. You know, what am I complaining about? No one. I'm talking about people who had their first one-man show approaching their 60s. I had none to complain about. But then I was in a show at the Theological Seminary, which he owned. His daddy founded. So you really, your bases aren't covered when you accost someone in this way. And the other thing I remember about this was that he asked me for money because he was putting dimes and quarters into this phone booth. And I had a friend who was sort of laggardly, I think he was hungover, that Ganny Brody. And he came staggering out of the subway and came across the street. I said, look, I got Nelson Rockefeller in there. Do you have any money? And they says, it was our strategy to go to the museum on Saturday to pick up girls. We never had any money, invariably. And Frank O'Hara or John Button would let us in, and they'd give us a ticket to go to the exclusive restaurant and bar on the third or fourth floor. And we'd go in there and we'd order a Duvernay. And on an empty stomach, it's disastrous. But we could tolerate that. We'd be drunk and, you know, the world belonged to us. And the Duvernay would cost a nominal $1.25 each, you see. And that's about what we had. We had about $5. And here we are coughing up money for one of the world's richest men. I don't know about Bill Gates now, but at that time.
Yeah.
And he consumed about all of our Duvernay money. And then he came out of the phone booth and skittered into the building. And we ran in there and we couldn't find him, you see. So I thought, then I became critical of my own behavior, particularly when I learned that in his vast world, I had a temporary place on a wall. I had no complaints, you know.
Right.
You see. Then another favorite place for us was if we'd had a chance, we had avant-garde artists who would teach at the New School. It was a New School with non-academic. Rather than professors, they'd have non-academic people. Mm-hmm. Or people like Max Lerner, who was a columnist and a super liberal, I suppose. And anyway, there was talk that the New School was closing down because of financial difficulties. And this was really compounded by Max Lerner and with the support of Maya Shapiro and dozens of other people. Dozens of other people. From the faculty who were on strike for more money. And the answer of the school was, we have no money, we are closing the New School. Anyway, a mysterious benefactor arrived and said, what do they want? They said, well, they want an extra $5 a week, you know. They want more than like a winter semester. They want a year-long contract. We can't afford this, Tommy Rock. And the mysterious benefactor said, give them what they want. And what do you need to operate this building? You've not met, and they mentioned this, and the mysterious benefactor gave them all sorts of money. And then the mysterious benefactor made a demand. He said, all this I'll give you if you cover up that fucking mural by Orozco in the cafeteria, which depicts my grandfather as eating what appears to be peanuts by our Mexican peasants. You destroy it, and they wouldn't destroy it, but they covered it, you see. And that was Nelson Rockefeller on one of his secretive forays. And also he began a war against those who survived the political order of things that represented social realism in painting, you know, and its left wing aspect, which is not dictated by the United States or New York, but you know, by Moscow, with a very influential messenger named Pablo Picasso. You see, I gotta stop for a second.